Hey, what's good, everyone? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances. We're talking about work and money doesn't suck, and millennials actually do some things right.
Very nice, sir. Very nice. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances.
So shout out to GoBlue99, CHow217, Sue Jag 2012, pretty sure I'm messing that up, and Azul Manzana, probably messing that up too. But thanks to all of these folks for the 5-star reviews that you left us on Apple Podcasts, formerly known as iTunes. I feel like we're getting a good amount of love this week, man.
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling the 5-star reviews, and I got one here from Sujag 2012. I'm going to butcher it like you or get it right like you. Millennial Money, 5 stars. This is the perfect podcast to help millennials, or this is a little editor's note, Xennials. For those of you who read that viral article that made me upset, figure out their finances. As a new graduate that has seen a significant increase in pay, I've learned how to handle that transition gracefully, and I feel that I'm making the best decision for my future. Exclamation mark.
I was wondering if you were going to mention the exclamation mark, bro.
Appropriately used exclamation mark, I might add.
It was, man.
And if you've been enjoying the podcast and think we're worthy of the 5 stars, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, formerly known as FKA, which I'm still struggling to learn because I'm a late adapter, iTunes. If you're on Twitter, the best thing you can do is share the show with your network. All you need to do is go to paychecksandbalances.com/lit and hit send.
I didn't know you were going to go to that octave, but I appreciate it, man. So on today's show, we've got a special guest. We're joined by Damon Young of Very Smart Brothers, one of the internet's go-to destinations for all things black. In part one, we discuss his journey to becoming a writer and starting VSB, what it's taken for him to get to where he is today, his biggest failure, which was quite interesting, and a lot more. And so part two will be dropping after the 4th of July, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that on the tail end of the show, because yeah, this is a two-parter, man. We had a nice lengthy conversation, and we just wanted to, you know, just split that up for the people.
And just to let y'all know as a heads up, we kept it pretty loose this episode, kept it real, no going viral on Friday, fired on Monday, but it does have a little bit of colorful language. If you're on your way to church on the car or in the car with your mother or grandmother, you may want to listen to this with your headphones on non-blast.
Indeed. Yeah, we definitely had a lot of fun. And, you know, I've always wondered if people think that we just keep it clean throughout life, because I know we normally do that on the regular podcast. So I've wondered if people just assume that we just like walk around buttoned up, like saying STFU in real life. But I actually use those terms quite frequently, man, like the actual words.
Well, I love a good F word, but I like to use it in like the minority so that when it's used, it like still has its oomph. You know, I like it to have a little bass to it. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, you know, like I like it to still catch people off guard. So it's like my last go-to word. I like to use words that I'm trying to bring back, like pussyfooting and stuff like that. You know, I'm still trying to keep that in the vernacular, if you will. But I feel like it needs to come back. Hussy. You know, I throw that out there. You know, hoochie. You know, I'm trying to bring that stuff back. Yeah, I'm an army of one, though.
I'm pretty for me. I'm vulgar. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed today's episode, part one with Damon Young, and we'll catch you on the back end.
Hoochie mama!
Today, we're joined by a writing-ass writer that's soon to be an authoring-ass author. He's currently a columnist for GQ.com and has had his work featured on places like Slate, The Root, Ebony, Essence, HuffPost, and pretty much everywhere. He's also the editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Black Culture Cornerstone, VerySmartBrothers.com, and Pittsburgh's finest, Damon the Champ Young. Thanks for joining us, fam.
I haven't heard Black Culture Cornerstone before. That's a first. When we're done with this, I'm going to edit my bio at the bottom of VSB, and I'm going to put that in there. Like, VSB is a cornerstone. Because, I just feel like that, you know, talking about the corner is just like inherently black. And I'm actually a little jealous that you thought of cornerstone before I did, because that just feels like it's just so apropos for us. But anyway, thank you. Thank you for having me. Welcome. Or should I be saying, you should be saying welcome.
I thought you were saying like, you're welcome. I was like, I mean, I guess so.
Well, you're welcome. You know, whatever we need to say to, you know, keep the conversation going. You know, I'm glad to be here.
I was going to say, man, you know, I realized the moment that you make it, and I think you've eclipsed one of those moments, is when I typed your name into Google, and before I could finish, the first result was Damon Young wife. And so at the point that enough women are searching you and trying to figure out who your wife is or if you have a wife, you're pretty far along the road to stardom, bro.
Oh, wow. Okay. I will say, I will hope that it is women searching for Damon Young wife and not white people trying to find information about my family. I will hope that it's the former, not the latter. So, hey, that's awesome.
Yeah, man. So I guess to just kind of get into it a little bit, I like to start with something that's a little lighter and on the fun side. So before you took over the blog and the writing game, I imagine you used to go on long walks, reflect on life and write poetry, man. So tell us a little bit about that poetry life back in the day. I think every brother has done that at some point in time.
Okay. So it's funny you bring this up because I'm actually, I wrote a chapter. One of the chapters in my book is about this whole poetry writing experience and the genesis of it and how it started. And, you know, I was in college when Love Jones was, you know, was like the thing that basically ruled the zeitgeist, and everyone wanted to be Darius Lovehall or have like that type of poetry relationship presence or whatever. And everyone wanted a Nina, Nina, whatever her name was. And so there was a girl that I liked, and I started writing these poems. And the first couple poems weren't actually even authentic poems. What I did was I went on originalhiphoplyricsarchive.com, and I cut and pasted Method Man's verse from Street Love. No doubt you got the best trout there could be, not an everyday average chicken out of sea. Candidate for HIV, you'd rather deal with monogamy, queen to be held, black mahogany. And I send it to her like, oh, look at this shit I just wrote for you. Okay. And so I did that, and she was like impressed, but not like the type of, like, I expected it to be like some Brother of the Night type shit where I read it and then then I get her phone number from like a record store and follow her to her apartment. And then, you know, we fall in love, and that didn't happen. But I continued writing. I stopped copying lyrics from from Wu-Tang and started writing my own shit. And then that ended up, you know, just progressing into me writing columns for the school newspaper there, and then being an editor for the newspaper there. And then it took off from there. But I wrote, like, I definitely wrote a lot of cringeworthy poetry. Like, it was like, okay, this is a line. This is an actual line in an actual poem that I wrote, and I distributed it to actual people. Okay, do you think Ali McBeal could deal with my long, strong Mandingo steel? I said that in a poem that I actually shared to the public.
Like, how much of the public, though?
Man. Like 17 people, probably. Whoever was on that email chain that I sent the poem to. And this, you know, and the thing is that I did at that point have a bit of a following. So people will look forward to, like, oh shit, Damon Young got some new riddance. D-Wack got some new riddance. And, you know, I sent it out there. And and this is the thing. Everyone's poetry was terrible. So there was, you know, there was no one telling me that it was terrible because everything was terrible. So I would send it out there and people were like, holy shit, that is so bomb. Oh, Ali McBeal. Oh, shit. And that was probably like 20 when I sent that. And again, I eventually stopped writing terrible poetry and started writing columns and then started blogging. My cousin Sarah Honey Young, who unbeknownst to me at the time, was already like a superstar blogger and internet person. And she offered to build me a website to archive my poetry. Because before, the only way I would keep them is I would email them to myself and just keep them in my inbox. And so she found out about this, was like, yo, I'll build you a site. And also on the site, you could do something called blogging.
What year was this? Do you remember what year this was?
This is 2002.
That's like back. So there wasn't even, I don't know if WordPress existed. It was like Zynga or TypePad or something.
I think that we were on Movable Type.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, I think that's the platform that that we were using was Movable Type. And then that started, and with the blog, I didn't really know what to do with it. You know, I would update it like maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks. But the thing is, because she was already a big deal, people were already like invested in what I had to say. Oh, he's Honey's cousin. So, you know, let me check this dude out. And so I started, you know, I would write and I would get comments and emails and things like that. And I guess just got more into it and almost addicted to that type of feedback and also the freedom that came with blogging and, you know, where you could have any type of, you know, editorial, tonal, creative, you know, whatever type of freedoms that you're searching for, you could find that there. I could write whichever, I could mess around with forms, I could do lists, I could number, I could write poems, I could just write stream of consciousness thoughts about pop culture or shit that just happened to me that day, or I was a teacher at that time, so I could write about that too. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, became addicted to that and stopped writing poetry altogether. And it's like, yeah, this blogging shit's kind of cool.
So I got a couple of follow-up questions. I'll ask them in reverse order. Do you think it sounds like you refined your craft. Do you think that's something that's been lost now with how much social media there is out there? I feel like that's something we can't do anymore. And then I didn't really do poetry, but I did terrible spoken words. So did you ever step out and do terrible spoken word as well?
Well, okay, I'll answer the first question. I'll answer the last question first. The poetry that I wrote was spoken word, except for I didn't perform it. So imagine like the worst spoken word performances that you've ever seen. But imagine if they weren't even actual performances. They were just words on paper.
Ooh, see, that's like rough.
Words on paper without any of the dramatization. Just
right.
Just extra words and punctuation and you know, all types of ways to rhyme, like patchouli and Bacardi and chakra and Badu. And so yeah, I think I may have read a poem out loud maybe 3 times in front of audience in my entire life. And once was when I was already done with college. I was like 25 years old.
Huh.
And so I guess for the second question, I feel like, you know, people are going to use it like any other tool. And, you know, people who want to refine their crafts are still going to be able to. Like, I don't think that the ubiquity of Twitter or Facebook or whatever and the immediacy that those forms, that those mediums call for, you know, we're always having to produce content and do that. I don't think it takes away from people who truly want to put in the work to refine, you know, their craft, whether that's writing or editing or whatever, because there's still a ton of space. There's even more space to do that.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm still doing it. You know, I do it publicly, but I'm still, you know, I would think that where I am right now, 2017, is even, you know, quite a ways from where I was in 2015. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I still think that there is space and there's time to be able to do that. You just, it depends on what you want to get out of this whole internet experience. And if you are a person who truly does want to get better at what you do, or you just want to be popular.
And you're willing to put in the work, man, because it's been years for you. And it's interesting because you talk about having your cousin kind of put you on with a built-in audience. And even as this book deal kind of came to life, which we'll talk about later in the show, it's a long, long grind. I mean, you basically been doing this for well over a decade at this point.
Yeah, I was in Memphis last week for my brother's keeper. Had an event there. And I moderated a couple panels, and a friend of mine is a deputy vice president or deputy director or whatever for them. And he just asked me if I wanted to be a part of this. And so I was talking to a kid in between one of the panels, and he just asked me how, you know, I was able to do what I did, what I do, and, you know, have VSB be this platform that's, you know, relevant and valuable. And I basically just told him, like, there's no such thing as an overnight success. You know, there's just that just doesn't happen. Like, perhaps, you know, a person that you may think of as an overnight success is someone that you just now heard of and weren't aware of them before. But, you know, even someone like Lovie, has been doing, like, she was around during those days back in 2003, 2004. Like, she's been around since then.
Yeah.
Too. With our own, you know, blogging and on message boards. And, you know, then when we launched VSB, she would always be in the comments there. So, you know, and again, she's another one who built her platform up, and now she's getting all types of national love and recognition and deals and whatever. But
Shonda Rhimes.
Yeah, Shonda Rhimes. But that was over a decade in the making. And yeah, so it takes a while. It took me a while. Now, there may be people who, you know, they may not take as long, but for someone like me who, you know, I'm not a person who, you know, I think I made this point in the last podcast I did, where I'm not a person who's from, like, one of the quote unquote, you know, cities that are relevant to Black people. I'm not from Chicago or D.C. or, you know, New York or L.A. or Houston or anything like Atlanta. Or anything like that. I have no connection to any HBCU or Ivy. I'm not an academic. I've never worked for, like, CNN or, you know, MSNBC or Fox or anything like that. So I'm kind of a bit of an independent in that aspect. I'm not connected to any fraternities. And so in order to, I guess, be able to do what I've done, I guess it had to take this time, because I had to create my own network, because I don't have any other networks that, you know, I was able to kind of ride the wave of or get some support from. So it had to be me building my own network, building my own platform. And that's something that, you know, that's going to take a bit of time.
It's interesting to hear you say that, man, because, you know, I'm from upstate New York, but, man, I lived in Boston. I lived in New York City. I lived, you know, now I'm living out in the Bay Area. You know, went to an Ivy League school, part of a fraternity. And I think even at times, I still feel like I'm kind of on the outside of things because I didn't have the HBCU experience, or because, you know, I didn't meet some internet defined version of what Blackness is. So. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you're kind of on the outside just because there are things that you hear that you've heard talked about, or conversations you didn't feel like you could get in, or people that didn't really want to rock with you? Or was there some other type of observation to kind of just made you say, I really got to go about this a different way?
I think that being an outsider, you know, or considering myself to be an outsider, perhaps made me more invested in building my own shit. Mm-hmm. And also too, I think that the writing I do tends to be a bit, like, observational, maybe a little distant, sometimes dry. That's just the type of humor that I usually employ. And so that distance helps, because that's also, like, my personality. So although I never had any of those networks, I've never wanted any of them. I've always preferred to kind of be a person. It's this weird dynamic where I've never been a follower or a leader. I just do what I do. I just exist. And if people want to rock with me, that's fine. If they don't, that's fine too. But I've never been, like, in the groups unless it was a group that I created. Mm. I feel like, I don't know. And I'm not going to say the road is easier for people who have those networks, because they have their own challenges that they have to deal with, you know, and also the fact that because I'm in Pittsburgh, because I don't have, you know, these other networks, I don't have to consider as many other personalities and politics and whatever that other people might have to. We're worried about hurting someone's feelings, or maybe getting promoted before someone else did, or maybe getting shined before someone else did. And I don't have to concern myself with that at all, because I, you know, I really don't know anybody person. And so those are like, when I see these back and forths, like on Facebook and Twitter, between like these writers that I know, but I don't know them, like I know of them and they know of me, but I don't know them personally. I'm always a bit of an observer, because I'm just not in that world. Mm. Like, I'm not at those parties. I'm not going to those events. I'm not doing any of that stuff. I'm just working here in Pittsburgh, going to stuff when I'm invited to it occasionally. And that's that. But I think that having that and having like a bit of a bubble has helped me just, you know, work on my own shit and work on building my own shit and not really give too many considerations to how other people are feeling or what other people are doing.
Yo, so I'll say that the 4 years that I lived in New York, while I had a lot of family, friends there, there was always something going on. But I'll say it was probably the unhealthiest 4 years that I've had in my life, just because there was so much going on and there was so much that I felt that I had to be at and shoulders that I felt that I need to be bumping up against. And, you know, all of these conversations that you have with people where, you know, where do you work? What do you do? Oh, I'm an entrepreneur. I launched this. I did that. I'm the chief editor for this. And it gets exhausting, man. So I'll say that there are times where, you know, I probably wish that I was in a different city, you know, even while living there, where I was somewhere that was a little bit more quiet. And I've experienced that since moving out to the Bay Area, where, yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of money that's out here. Everything is tech, tech, tech. But I don't feel that same pressure that I felt when I lived in a city as big as New York to be involved in so many things. And it's I think it's coincidental that a lot of the progress with this podcast, with other things in life, those things really started to pick up. And I was able to focus a lot more on what I wanted and sticking to one thing by being kind of separated and isolated from a lot of the shenanigans and professional events and everything else that's going on in the typical metropolises. That's probably not a word, but I'm gonna go with it.
If you say it, it's a word. That's my credo. If it escapes your mouth, and it's officially a word.
Yeah, man. So how do you feel about, because you talk about not being a follower, not being a leader, but naturally as you continue to rise, you have a site like VSB, and we'll talk about how that got going in a second. How do you deal now with like people kind of thrusting you into that leadership role? Or do you feel that people are putting you in that role and putting you on a pedestal now that you're at this point where you have all these things going on? You've been doing this for over a decade. You know, more people, it seems like if someone doesn't know who you are and they're of color, I'm surprised. So I guess, how do you deal with that now where you are more visible, even though you are remote essentially in Pittsburgh, but you go to these events, I'm sure you have people who are hitting you up. I guess, how are you handling that?
Well, to answer your first question, you know, I do recognize that as VSB grows and as both VSB's relevance or platform grows and my own, you know, separate from VSB continues to grow, then yeah, people are going to look to me for thoughts about certain things and you know, something happens that, you know, has to do with race or politics or pop culture, whatever. There, people are looking to me for a certain type of reaction to it. And so I do recognize that, and I'm cognizant of that, and I am still kind of figuring out how to reconcile with that, you know, with, you know, that new status, but also with who I am, and just trying to find some type of medium there that works for me. Because again, I don't want to be like, I've never really wanted to be like the voice for a certain type of blackness. I want to be my voice. Like, this isn't, you know, what Black America feels or whatever. This is what Damon feels. This is how Damon feels. But again, I do recognize that the more, I guess, popular or whatever that I get, then the more I lose that. Mm-hmm. And again, that's something that, you know, I am still trying to figure out, like how to navigate that, because I don't want to be subsumed by like that type of expectation. But at the same time, I recognize that that type of expectation comes with being, you know, having a certain type of prominence. So, mm-hmm. I'm not a person who just wants to, you know, just keep logging in some little corner of the internet and have like 17 people read my shit. I do not want that at all. Like, I want to be known me as like, oh, this is Damon is a great writer. Damon does this. PSB is a great platform. But I also want to maintain some sort of independence, mm-hmm. Where people don't look to us and look to me as like, you know, if VSB writes a piece and, you know, that isn't just complete shit on Hillary Clinton, that must mean that they support Hillary Clinton. VSB officially supports, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like something like that happening. And I just, to answer your question, I'm still figuring it out.
No, I get it, man. Because I know me and Marcus, we've both been in the blog game for a while too. And I think what's interesting is as you do grow and your influence grows, you find yourself, you know, also maybe being a little bit more thoughtful about what you write. And it seems like you're pretty open about and pretty transparent about kind of much of what's going on in your personal life, also what's going on in the world. Do you find yourself having to filter more, or do you find yourself being more thoughtful, or you're just kind of like, fuck it, this is me, I'm putting it out there at this point?
It depends on the topic. Like it depends on the topic and the mood and when you're going to catch me. Because I feel like I've done a really good job of giving myself the veneer of transparency. When it comes to like certain like relationship stuff, if I talk about marriage or fatherhood, I've talked about money a couple times in the last 6 months. When I talk about my health scare that I had a few months ago, but there are things that, and I say the veneer of transparency because there are things that I just will not discuss on VSB.
So like the thing is, you may not be able to answer this by virtue of not being able to discuss it, but like, what's an example of something that you're just not trying to put out there into the world? Or type of topic, I'll put it that way.
Type of topic would be, you know, let's say, and I'm not saying this is true, but let's say that my wife and I were having some issues with our marriage. Like I'm not, you will never see anything like that on VSB. That just will not be a topic of conversation. That will not be something that's up for public consumption on the site. Now, and the thing is, I write about marriage a lot and I reference my wife, you know, pretty frequently, but I am not going to, you know, write about something or put something out there that might actually affect our marriage in a negative way.
Got it.
At least I won't consciously do that, because there are sometimes there have been times where I've said something and she's read it and be like, you know, I wish you wouldn't have said that.
Yeah. But,
you know, that happened. So.
And so VSB, the site started, what was it, 2007?
2008.
And yeah. I guess, so a lot of people probably know how it came about, but for those that don't, how did VSB become a thing? How did you and Panama hook up? Or connect. Hook up, I know in 2017 has a lot of different meaning, so let me just be safe there.
Hey man, not that there's anything wrong with that either. Panama's a handsome guy, he's light skinned, you know. So, you know, hey, it's the 21st century. We hooked up. We first hooked up back in like 2004, where we 2004, maybe 2005, where we both were a part of like the Black blogosphere back then. And we just gravitated toward each other, ended up connecting, became friends. And around 2007, I want to say, we both stopped blogging for reasons, but we stayed cool with each other. And then in 2008, us and another mutual friend, Liz Burr, decided to come together and create VSB. And it was and the thing is, when we started, it was our focus was dating relationships and sex. We wanted to be kind of the tongue-in-cheek and irreverent counterpoint to like the Steve Harveys and the Hill Harpers and everyone else who had a relationship bulk or platform at that time. And we chose that because when we had our personal blogs, we both noticed or recognized that the blogs that would get the most comments and get the most traffic were ones that dealt with those topics in some form. So we were just thinking, hey, you know, why don't we just start blogging again, have like this group blog and focus primarily on those topics so that, you know, we take the fan base that we already have from our, you know, respective platforms, put them together. And also we have these, we're talking about this topic that people are seem to gravitate towards.
That's some real Captain Planet shit.
Yeah. I don't get that reference.
Yo,
you have to explain that to me. Yo, yeah, I get the Captain Planet reference. Please break it down.
When your powers combine, man.
See, if you would have said Voltron or Wu-Tang or something like that, I would have been a little bit more. I'm not a millennial, but I'm not a Gen Xer either. So I'm like in that in-between space. And actually, so for people in that in-between space, you need to make like the references need to be like maybe Transformers, Voltron. I was going not even Power Rangers because Power Rangers came after.
I was thinking that next as you were talking. I was like, that might have been a little bit Power after Rangers, for you.
I was already like a teenager when Power Rangers were a thing. So I'm old just in case that hasn't come across already. I'm an old ass nigga.
So I was watching Dave Chappelle stand up. So it could be the Care Bears, but I feel like nobody wants to own that. And
you
then
you know what? The Care Bears actually, Care Bears might actually be the most appropriate, even though Care Bears are totally not gangsta at all. But if we want to make the right reference with what we were just talking about, then yeah, we came together like the Care Bears. Join forces like those motherfucking Care Bears.
All right. We'll go with that. So that's not where I thought we would land on that one, but I'm gonna go with it. Okay. So y'all join forces like Care Bears. And when VSB became a thing, did you have any idea that it could become what it is today?
I did not. I did not think that I'd be sitting here in 2017 with you know, with the stuff that has happened in the last year and a half happening. I did want for VSB to be a springboard for me to eventually, you know, be a quote unquote writer, like capital letter W writer, and have people take me seriously as that. But in my mind, I was thinking, you know what? VSB will serve my resume and I'll go and I don't know, I'll have a column at like Slate or something, which is still great, you know, like a great job to have. Or I'll be a person that writes think pieces for Slate and for The Atlantic or things of that nature. I didn't envision VSB itself becoming valuable. And although I did want to, I started thinking about writing a book or my own book, and maybe around 2009, 2010, I didn't envision the type of deal that I eventually ended up getting. Mm. So I had ambitions. What's ended up happening with VSB with my own just personal success has surpassed those ambitions.
Funny how that works, man. I don't think anyone ever says like that's exactly what I envisioned it would be, but it's interesting to hear the variations and the answers on that.
And also, I want to say this too, is that when I started VSB, I was working at Duquesne University in the School of Business. There, I was running a college prep program where we connected high school students with volunteer mentors from the community to help them kind of figure out their post-secondary paths. And in 2009. When the recession hit, this program lost its funding. And so I was out of a job. And I applied for a couple more positions in like college offices, like admission counselor or, you know, academic advisor, things of that nature in the colleges and universities around the Pittsburgh area. And I didn't get any of them. I got a couple interviews, but I didn't get hired. And so at that point, I was like, you know what? Do I want to continue like bumping my head against this wall? Or do I want to see if I could know, put some effort and energy in the VSB and actually make it a thing. And also at that time, I used a lot of that time to edit and curate the entries that would eventually go into the bulk that we released in 2011. Now, Your Degree Is Gonna Keep You Warm at Night. So I guess I'm bringing that up to say, if I don't get laid off at Duquesne, I probably still stay in academia in some fashion, or stay working in some college office or something and continue, you know, VSB as a bit of a hobby, but not something that I took as seriously as I ended up taking. So even that is, I guess, some sort of serendipity that ended up happening, because it is one of those things where I could swim now, but the only reason I could swim is because someone pushed me into the pool.
Yeah. And that seems to be a common story for people where a layoff, a child, something dramatic happened in life that put them on the path to success. And I also remember earlier within the VSB time, you and Panama were, and I want to say this is probably up until like 2014. I can't get the years right anymore, but you and Panama, your co-founder, were alternating 4 weeks of blog posts. So I imagine that there was a time period where you were juggling working in academia, VSB, and also doing, you know, freelance writing as well. So that's a lot. How are you able to balance doing all of that?
I balance it because I had to, because that's those pieces that I was freelance pieces and whatever, and t-shirts that we were selling, those were phone bills. Those were car payments. Those were, brunches. If I wanted to go to brunch, those were, car insurance payments or whatever. You know, those were Pornhub memberships, whatever I was using, whatever I needed the money for, that's what that money was for. So I was able to juggle doing all that because I had to, because I didn't have any other option. And so I was, just kind of forced to be prolific out of necessity. And because I prefer having money to not having it.
Let me first and foremost say that I didn't even know, and I'm going to say PH had a membership, so I don't even know what's on the dark side.
I just threw that out there because, yeah, they I think they have memberships now.
I'm actually terrified to think what else I could access. My friends could access.
You could get like high definition, like or something. I don't know, but 3D glasses. Yeah, I don't think they had memberships then. I was just throwing this random pornographic site out there for a joke, for levity's sake.
I won't even go down. I'm going to go ahead and close that off. So you started with relationship to grow your audience.
I could have said Bang Bros. I could have said that.
Yeah, that's better.
When did you realize it was time to expand beyond the relationships topics, I should say?
Probably around 2010.
Very specific. So why 2010?
Well, no, I'm just thinking it was probably like maybe around 2 years after VSB started that we started like expanding and just writing about more stuff.
So let me ask this follow up. So as Rich has mentioned, we tried to do, I guess we didn't try, I guess we were doing the same. We didn't get a lot of the buy-in at first. Did you see a drop off when you tried to expand your topics, or did people readily embrace it? Did the audience split? What was your level of success the first time you expanded beyond relationships?
We have had a pretty steady growth throughout our existence. Like every year we've gained traffic, we've been lucky enough not to plateau. And so I think that, our audience actually probably wanted, we're already here every day, talking about these topics. So why not have it be a place where we could, also talk about politics and also talk about race and also talk about, pulp culture or sports or whatever. So, yeah, there was no pushback whatsoever when we decided to expand our content. If anything, that helped us grow quicker. Mm. And also, too, I think that there was a certain point when being a quote-unquote relationship blogger became like a pejorative. Yeah. And And even if you had good content, or even if you had, you know, your heart in the right place, I feel like, you know, being known as that was a, like a bit of an insult, or considered to be a bit of an insult, or like this something you would say to dismiss someone, like, oh, he's a relationship blogger. So I feel like that the move away from that was with that in mind, was like, you know what, I don't want VSB to be a place that is considered to be like this relationship blog. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want that to be like the first thing people think of when they think of me. And I think if you were to ask Panama, he might say the same thing.
So when do you think that changed, though? Because, and it's, and as we're going through this, there's some stuff I'm like trying to figure out like what to ask you. And I'm like, I know a lot of this because I've been kind of along for the journey in some way or another. And I know that the relationship era like went on for a while and then it just became toxic. So what do you think changed that, you know, at what point did it go from this is the place to be to nah?
I think it just I can't necessarily pinpoint an exact moment, but I think it just hit a critical mass where it was just so ubiquitous. I mean, Nightline was doing specials about single Black women, and like, you know, there were all these books, and, you know, Think Like a Man, Act Like a Woman, or whatever the fuck was a movie. And it just reached a critical mass where people were just tired of that conversation. And just hearing the same things basically said over and over again. And, you know, and again, I'm sure you all, you know, can speak to that as well, where, and the thing is, it's like, I personally just felt like that there was a limit to what I could talk about there, because after you've gone through that topic enough times, you've run out of ways you've run out of things to talk about.
Yeah.
And again, that combined with the pushback, you know, and also, you know, I really do think that Twitter becoming a thing in, like, you know, like 2009, 2010 also helped to end that era, because, you know, you had an avenue for people to just immediately push back on all that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, whereas, you know, I guess before Twitter, if you didn't have your own blog, if you didn't have your own space, and I don't know if people were really using Facebook for that purpose, but if you didn't have your own space, then, you know, it might have been a little bit more difficult to have, you know, that type of reaction, that type of pushback to certain types of content. But, you know, when Twitter became a thing and everyone, you know, anyone could have access to that and could respond to things in a certain way, then I think that really exacerbated the downfall of that era.
Yeah, because that, I know that heat comes quickly, man. As soon as you press publish, within 5 minutes, if someone doesn't like it, if you don't know about it in the comments, you know about it on Twitter or Instagram or one of the other platforms. So that definitely makes a big difference. And so overall, what y'all have done is super inspirational. And where there's inspiration, there's often envy. So what do you say to people that envy you, who are kind of looking at where you are, looking at what you've done and saying, I want to be like Damon. I'm frustrated with where I am today. Things aren't moving as quickly. What do you say to those people who are really envying to be in your position?
Well, if that is true, if there are people who are envious, I would, and I had an opportunity to talk to them, I'd ask them why, like, what exactly are they envious of? And I would let them know, you know, again, what I said earlier in the podcast is that, you know, whatever success or whatever that I'm having today, it's stuff that has been building for over a decade. So if you put in 15 years of work and, or let me put it this way, if you feel a certain way about, you know, the success that someone like me or someone like Lovey or whoever else has had, and you haven't put in a decade of success, then I really feel like you don't really have anything to say. Just because in order to be successful, you have to put in the work, and the work sometimes takes years, decades. And yeah, so again, for people who maybe feel that way, I would just tell them that, you know, it hasn't, I could as soon as 2012, 2013, you know, I remember getting a late check from Ebony. I was working for Ebony magazine at the time, and that set in motion a series of events that ended up leading to my car getting repossessed. So that, and that was 4 years ago. That wasn't that long ago, you know, and so I bring that up because I don't want to get on like some soap box and talk about, you know, how hard it's been and how hard it is to be successful or whatever. But all I'm saying is that although certain successes might be public, there are a lot of private failures and private anxieties and private angst that, you know, maybe you just haven't been around long enough to see. And if you're willing to go through all of that, then great. But if you're not, then, you know, I don't feel like you have any room to possess any sort of envy.
Right, right. So I've heard you mention on when you were on Leasing Nicole Bell's podcast, Behind the Brilliance, I encourage folks to check that out if they have not already. I heard you mention that you're very competitive with yourself. So how do you avoid turning that from a positive to a negative? Because some people, they're competitive with themselves and they become frustrated and it's almost like they're too competitive. They become a perfectionist. They're not putting stuff out there. They got stuff sitting in drafts for 3 to 4 years. How do you find that balance with yourself?
I don't know any other way to be. I it's hard for me to answer that question because I don't know how to be another way. I just don't. So there's no like questions about balance or anything like that, because I can't even conceive of how I would balance or what I would balance.
Yeah. It sounds like it's just innate to who you are. That's just the way you operate.
Yeah. Yeah. I am obsessed with getting better at this, and it's something that has driven me. And even with, you know, with some people, they get some success and that stops. But with me, it's just given me like more fuel to just continue going. And I don't really know how to explain it. Like I haven't gone on a vacation since my honeymoon. And even on my honeymoon, I was out there in the middle of the ocean on a cruise buying the cruise Wi-Fi to edit some shit that I had written 3 weeks earlier and already published. But it just stuck. There was like a typo or something or a line that was just in my head that I just couldn't stop thinking about. And if you've been on a cruise, you know, the Wi-Fi is like $1,000 a minute or something crazy like that. And I'm in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean editing some shit that no one else gives a fuck about. You know, no one was ever going to read this shit again, or even maybe read it and not even notice the line or the typo. But I just don't know how to be any other way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm hearing consistency, focus, shit, excellence. I'm sure there's a bunch of other positive and inspirational words that people would throw in there. But before we jump to talking a little bit more about money, what would you say has been we've talked a lot up to this point about success and what you've accomplished, but what would you say has probably been the biggest failure you've had so far? And what have you learned from that?
Biggest failure. Biggest failure definitely had to be a piece I wrote in 2012. It was a piece about sexual assault, and it was just terribly conceived, terribly written, terribly premised. Like everything about it was just a complete and utter fail. And it was such a fail that I'm struggling to come up with the words to explain how much of an abject fail that was. And, you know, we lost a lot of support, lost a lot of fans. I hurt a lot of people. I hurt a lot of people who, you know, were close to me or friends with me, who, you know, were just flabbergasted and just shocked that I would write something like that and publish it. You know, people who came to VSB for, you know, for the connectivity and the community and the levity and the humor and the insight and all that. and, you know, to come to have like this quote unquote safe space and then come log on to VSB one day and see something like that was just, you know, I heard a lot of people, and it was something that I received a ton of perfectly justified negative pushback from and criticism. And it's, you know, it's, again, it's one of those things where when you know you fuck up and you just can't do anything but just, you know, it feels like shit when you're getting this criticism, but there's really nothing you can say because you're like, yeah, I fucked up and I just got to take it because this is what it is. But after that, I just did a lot of soul searching. And, you know, I know that term is a cliche that athletes use a lot. You know, I did a lot of soul searching after we lost. And like, what the fuck? What soul are you searching after you lost the fucking basketball game? You just get better at basketball or sign Kevin Durant, one or two. So I did a lot of soul searching and just trying to figure out, you know, what was inside of me that would make me think it was okay to print that. What was inside of me that would make me think it was okay to even think those thoughts and that it was okay to print that. And also to, you know, what type of platform I want VSB to be, what type of person I want to be, what type of writer I want to be. And so, you know, I was like, you know, I don't want to be known for this. I don't want to hurt people like this. I don't want to have a platform that's known for doing stuff like this. And so I was like, you know, I need to get better. I need to get better. And not just a better writer. I need to get better at being a person. I need to be a better thinker. I need to be a better editor. I need to be more discerning. I need to be a better friend. I need to be a better, you know, boyfriend or whatever. And you know, it's been 5 years since then, and I hope that, you know, that I've been able to make some recognizable progress. But yeah, that was definitely like a point in my professional career that was the low point.
Yeah.
And I just like a month earlier gotten hired by Ebony.
Ooh, that's bad. That's real bad timing.
Yeah, and I was also thinking, shit, I'm gonna lose my job. You know, I've been working all this time to be able to get hired by a place like Ebony, and I just threw that all down the toilet. And, you know, fortunately, friends like Jamila was, you know, stood Ebony, the people at Ebony, you know, didn't just throw me under the bus then. And that's Jamila, that's Karina, that's Janice, you know, and all the women that I work with at Ebony, you know, because they could have, and they would have been perfectly justified to do that, but they didn't, and I'll always be indebted to them for that.
Yeah, let me jump in with a comment here. It's two part. Number one, it's one of those things where I guess we have a small, large, I really don't even know how to describe these things, but we are definitely a niche on the internet. And this didn't even happen to me. And I remember when this is happening. So as you walk through this, I was like, yeah, I remember that, man. That was a tough time. It didn't even happen to me. I was like, man, it was one of those things that made an impression on the internet. And I was like, and I was just observing. So, you know, it's very good. And I think for the folks who don't have that context to hear the lessons learned that came from that. Was there anything that some of the, I'm going to say season, but was there any advice that you got from others, especially since you were taking over that transition, you possibly could? And I think now over the years, we've seen people that 140 characters, you know, get them out of a job, let alone an entire blog. Was there any seasoned veteran advice that you got during that time as well?
I can't necessarily think of any like particular advice that I got from like that I could pinpoint that I got from one person. It was mostly people just saying, you know, it was mostly people just saying, you have all of these friends, female friends, who, you know, you could run shit past before you publish. Why not do that? Mm. You know, why not have a conversation? Why not, you know, why would you think it was like okay to do that? And as I mentioned earlier, I was on the panel, a couple panels in Memphis last week. And one of the things that one of the panels was social media, dealt with social media, and I was moderating. And one of the things that I said was that, and this is a room that's full of mostly young people. Like, I think the age group was 16 to 29, maybe, is that you can have flippant opinions about the NBA Finals or about Big Sean or about chicken wings or, you know, about topics that people get heated about, but those opinions don't really mean anything. You're not going to hurt anyone's feelings. You're not going to trigger anyone. But once you start delving into race, religion, gender identity, sexual assault, things of that nature, abortion, you better know what the fuck you're talking about. And you better make sure that, you know, the shit that you said, that you say, that you publish, considers every angle, has done the research, has talked to the people that you need to talk to, you know, and if you haven't done any of that stuff, that's great, but just don't say anything. There's always, you know, shutting the fuck up is free. And
let's go to the episode.
And again, that's my advice for anyone who is an up and coming blogger, writer, internet person, whatever, is that, you know, when you get into those explosive topics of conversation, know what the fuck you're talking about before you say shit publicly.
Yeah.
Because you just can't apply that same flippancy to those type of topics that you might when you're talking about, I don't know, LaVar Ball, or you're talking about, I don't know, Meek Mill, or you know what I mean? Yeah, like you have to be able to discern and have to be able to recognize that, yeah, when I'm talking about these topics, I have to know what the fuck I'm talking about, or I'm not saying anything at all.
Right, right. I mean, I think sometimes what happens though is people build a large following and they think that they become pretty much impervious to anything. And because people look to them for their perspective on one thing, that it's okay for them to give their perspective on everything, which I guess what you're saying is it may be okay, but as long as you've done your research and you actually know what the fuck you're talking about. But it doesn't sound like you're saying that people need to be experts in a topic, more so that they need to be informed. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say, yeah, you need to be informed. But I think with certain topics, like if you are certain topics that have the ability to make, you know, to really upset people and like really hurt people, you should both be informed, and you should also acknowledge that you don't know shit. If that makes sense. Like, let's say, hey, I'm not an expert. These are my informed thoughts, but I am not an expert. In fact, if you want an expert thought, go to this person, go to this website and get them there. Cause this is just my reaction. But again, even that could be tricky and messy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds more like basically STFU, unless you really know what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, unless you know what the hell you're talking about, you know, and particularly if you're a person who is weighing in on the subject that you're not a part of the group that you're weighing in. Like if you're a white person talking about race, for instance, and you want to talk about race and racism, if you don't know what the fuck you're talking about, shut the fuck up and just listen. You know, if you're a man talking about like street harassment or sexual assault or something like that, shut the fuck up, unless you're just saying, hey, this thing that's happening is fucked up and we need to stop doing it.
Yeah.
But if there's no space, no room for you to offer an account, like a counter opinion. Like there's no room for you to be the devil's advocate there. You could be the, again, you could be the devil's advocate with most other topics. You could do that when you're talking about the NBA finals. You could do that when you're talking about grits. Like I personally don't give a fuck about grits. I think the conversation people have about grits and sugar and salt, you know, it's whatever. Grits don't matter enough to me to make those distinctions. And I can say that because, you know, no one's going to get in their feelings about grits.
Yeah.
But there are other topics that, you know, people will get in their feelings about, and those feelings will be justified and you will deserve it. And yeah, you should just shut the fuck up.
So inevitably, you know, this episode is going to go fine, except for that grit comment going viral, probably be on Medium somewhere.
I've written about my grit, I guess grit apathy before. And I've had friends reach out to me as like, yo, grits are essential. Grits are necessary. Grits are good. But I don't know. I feel like the conversation about the grits that happened last year is like having a conversation about like LeVar Ball shoes, the Big Baller brand shoes. Like they're, cause the shoes, like if you take away the price tag from them shoes, they're not the ugliest shoes ever. They're just average looking shoes. But arguing about grits is like arguing about those shoes, because those shoes look like 1,000 other pair of shoes at Finish Line. They just have a $500 price tag on them now.
Yeah.
And this analogy didn't quite work, but I imagine that you all know what I'm talking about.
I got it.
They can't all be winners. I get it.
That's true.
I know. I already had mine this episode where I used Captain Planet and we ended up at the Care Bears. So I totally get it.
That was a good pivot. Like I'm going to start using that. We came together like the Care Bears to, you know, Voltron is completely gone from my writerly lexicon now. It's all Care Bears from now on. No more Wu-Tang, no more Voltron, no more X-Men. It's Care Bears.
Fam, I really did not expect Care Bears to become an instrumental part of this episode, man.
Yo, all we do is win. Shout out to Dave Chappelle. You know, I can't take full credit for that one. But I think it's relative. I really don't even know. As we were going through that, I was like, man, what even comes together anymore? And I actually do think like the mighty Power Rangers is the more relative to the younger millennials. I'd actually be interested. So if you do write in, plug with a 5 stars, what is your Voltron? This week's question.
Yo, do you remember VR Troopers?
Man, loosely. I actually remember, what were the Tiger Cats or the Fear Cats? Thundercats.
Oh, yeah. You said Tiger. I was like T-Cats.
Yeah. I was like, man, I know there was some cats, and I can't remember the storm that came before them. So Thundercats, I used to watch that religiously.
I never quite got into that. And every time I say that, people take a real deep inhale.
Yeah, no, I get it. I feel like it was a niche.
Yeah, it kind of felt like that way with VR Troopers too. But anyway, I know we still got a lot to talk about on the money side of things, but I really hope people got something from that first part, that journey. And it really is weird to have watched someone over the years. I remember when I first got into blogging, and I remember going on VSB and commenting, and that sort of being an inspiration for when I started an old blog a few years back. Shout out to Three Ways to Take It for those that remember it. But yeah, on part two, we talk more about the money side of things, a little bit about parenting, an article he wrote not too long ago about VSB that deals with money. So really looking forward to getting that out there. And that episode will be dropping the week after the 4th of July, because we too need to take a break, man. We've been going week after week for a long time.
Yeah, I realize this is my first real 10-day vacation, like a real vacation. Like I'm even at the point, based on something that happened recently, to be perfectly honest, like I'm not even checking the work phone. I'm not logging in. Like I'm like, that's what I'm saying in my head anyway. I'm definitely not taking my work computer, but this is my first vacation in like 18 months, man. And it just goes by. You know, days go slow, years go fast. Like I didn't realize how much time had passed between the true vacation. So yes, I'm going to embrace it. I will be checking the tweets, but I won't be checking the work phone.
Yo, I haven't had a 10-day vacation since, and I don't even know if I would call this a vacation per se, when I drove across the country to live out here. Like, I don't think I've ever taken a vacation that many days off straight.
Speaking of which, I hope our listener learning from this discussion right now took that time off. Maybe you should write in and give us an update. There was a listener question about should you take off time between work. I hope you did it. Break free from the matrix. Learn from us. Do as we say, not as we do.
I hope so. So thanks to everyone for listening. Hope you'll be back around for part two. And again, if you really enjoyed this episode, definitely share it with your network. And don't forget to join our email list where we share our helpful stories we read throughout the week, actionable work and money tips, and more. You can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
And you can also interact with us and other members of the PNB Nation on Facebook. Join the group by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/Facebook.
And yeah, we'll see you next time. So until then, be safe. We out. Peace.